At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Take everything we produce in this economy, all the goods and all the services, and add it up. What does it come to? Well, not as much as we'd like, honestly. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 27th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Now, don't get me wrong. This economy is still growing. Gross domestic product grew at an annualized rate of 1.1% in the first quarter. That is not so bad given everything that's going on out there. But 1.1% in Q1 is slower growth than the 2.6% growth we saw in the last quarter of last year, and that was slower than the quarter before that. And you know where I'm going, right? One's not a trend, two's not a trend, three, yeah, that's a trend. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with where that trend might be taking us.
There were some major things holding the economy back last quarter.
But it was really business investment that wound up being a bigger drag, as well as some of the inventory numbers.
Marvin Lowe is senior global macro strategist at State Street Global Markets. Businesses were not in a mood to invest a lot this past quarter, not in equipment and not in filling up their inventory. Why might that be?
If you don't think that the economy is going to be particularly strong going forward, it doesn't make sense to invest heavily in your inventories and your productive capacity right now.
John Lear is chief economist at Morning Consult. Plus, higher interest rates have made it more expensive to take out loans to buy some big piece of equipment or other. And banks have been less willing to make big loans. New housing construction is also down. That's more dead weight. And yet, despite all of this, the economy still grew 1.1%.
The big driver for Q1 was consumption growth.
Jonathan Fingal is chief U.S. economist at UBS. You and me and everybody else kept buying stuff. We spent more on cars, healthcare, eating out, hotels, retirees got cost of living adjustments. And all of that has kept the economy growing. But there is a limit to just how much consumers can keep saving the day.
Inflation wears you down.
This is John Lear again. Inflation is making consumers less willing and able to spend like they used to.
And we saw this early on with low and middle income Americans, and it has worked its way up the income ladder.
Inflation's making even higher income Americans walk away from big ticket purchases, Morning Consult surveys show. Jonathan Fingal at UBS says if you look at the trend in demand the past couple quarters,
that to me looks like an economy that is slowing down.
He predicts we'll get a recession before the year's out, but maybe we won't. Ben Herzon is a senior U.S. economist with S&P Global Market Intelligence, which predicts GDP growth will shrink to just 0.4% by June.
The slowdown that we're seeing doesn't necessarily mean we're heading for recession. I think it does mean we're heading for a period of slow growth.
There's a lot that can mess with that prediction. Debt ceiling drama, inflation readings, the banking system. The economy is entering a tenuous place where things could really go either way. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders clearly don't care about GDP. They don't care about the debt limit. They are just looking for a reason to buy. And buy indeed today they did. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Couple of data points of interest coming out tomorrow, and this goes to exactly what Sabri was just talking about. We'll get consumer spending for March, Also, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which regular listeners to this program know is of special interest to the Federal Reserve. Those two measures of this economy meet in the latest batch of corporate earnings reports we've been getting. McDonald's and Pepsi, Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark, too, have all reported big first quarter profits. They have also all raised prices, and they say so far that has not driven their customers away. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
We hold some economic truths to be self-evident.
Companies always want to raise prices. Companies always want to make more money.
David Wessel is at the Brookings Institution.
And what has happened in recent times is demand, particularly demand for goods, have been very strong. And that has allowed companies to increase prices.
In many cases, he says, more than their own costs have gone up. And we still keep buying.
What we are seeing from companies is that they are still able to pass along price increases with an amazing acceptance rate as high as 95%.
Andrew Sicilla at Alex Partners says executives at those companies know that won't be the case forever. Consumers will pull back eventually.
I think a lot of people are putting contingency plans in place for when that happens. But in the current situation, they're continuing to push through the price increases.
There is evidence that consumers are starting to get more sensitive to rising prices and change some of what they're buying, says Ottoman Özyıldırım at the Conference Board.
There are some categories where there are generic brands. It's an easy switch to make.
That's especially true with certain kinds of foods, like cereal, and with clothes. Joanne Hsu at the Surveys of Consumers at the University of Michigan says people are getting increasingly frustrated with persistent inflation.
I think last year, during the peak of inflation, consumers understood that supply chains were really putting a lot of upward pressure on prices. A lot of those supply chain constraints have eased since then. And so consumers are continuing to be very frustrated that prices remain so incredibly high.
But for the most part, she says they're still continuing to spend because they just don't have a whole lot of options. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We're a good week or so into spring, officially. Local weather patterns may vary, of course. But in a lot of places, professional landscapers are out digging and planting and generally sprucing up parks and walkways and schools. But it's really hard work, that landscaping is, and it's not all that well paid. You throw in an already tight labor market, and hiring is challenging at best. That's where foreign labor comes in. And in fact, this year, the federal government has already maxed out the number of seasonal worker visas that it issues. That is benefiting, it turns out, both foreign workers and the landscaping companies that employ them. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovel has the story.
In this corner of Herman Park, on a sunny but not too hot Houston day, I come across about a dozen workers in neon vests and white hard hats. They're working on the city's park enhancement project, adding playgrounds, sidewalks, trees. Juan Pablo Alvarez Miranda is planting a dwarf wax myrtle.
Ya está. De ahí procedemos a sacarlo.
Alvarez Miranda is one of tens of thousands of landscaping workers in the U.S. on temporary visas.
Tengo ya 7 años.
He's been coming to the U.S. from his home in eastern El Salvador for 7 years. He stays in a two-bedroom apartment with three other temporary landscaping workers from the same small town. They were recruited by a manager for a Houston landscaping company who's from the same area. They've known each other since they were kids. While in Houston, they do everything together in the pickup truck they share.
Andamos en la misma troca.
Whether it's buying food or going to the bank to send money home. And Alvarez Miranda manages to send back a lot, $20,000 last year. He works 6 days a week and wages are good. He says in just 2 hours doing landscaping work, he makes what he would bring home after a whole day working in El Salvador, $30. Even so, spending 6 to 10 months a year away from his wife and 2 daughters weighs on him.
Entonces eso es lo que más se siente aquí triste uno por la...
He remembers his first year. He had to leave his daughter, who was just 6 months at the time. When he came back, she didn't know who he was. Now, Alvarez Miranda is working with his employer, Landscape Art, to get a permanent visa to bring his family to Houston. If it works out, this is kind of a best-case scenario. A lot of employers are not willing to help. I say goodbye to Alvarez Miranda and step into the car with Landscape Art owner Rebecca Dubisky.
Rosewood.
Okay.
Lescott.
Okay. All right. We are on the way.
As we drive to another work site, she says this year the government awarded her company 25 temporary visas, the most they've ever had.
25 visas, that represents about $3.5 million of revenue for us.
On the flip side, when they don't get visas,
we lose out on that revenue, and meaning that we can't do jobs that we've already been awarded. We can't bid new jobs.
Jose Filiberto Garcia Avila works with Dubisky. He's originally from Mexico and used to be a temporary worker, but now lives in Houston full time thanks to a company supported permanent visa. When I ask if the program changed his life, he grins and says, yeah, he's got better working conditions, is more financially stable, and has a career he feels good about. He says next time you take a stroll through a park or on a new sidewalk, you can see how workers like him contribute. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there is the capacity for outrage.
There is always, it seems. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 524 today, 1.6%, closed at 33,826. The NASDAQ up 287 points, 2.4%, hence the really happy music, 12,142. The S&P 500 lifted 79 points, about 1.9%, 41.35 there. We heard from Sabri about GDP growing 1.1% last quarter, lower than previously, in part because of housing construction, which is down. Toll Brothers gained 2.7% today. Pulte Group grew 2.5%. Lowe's up 1.8%. Air carriers say they're expecting a busy travel season. American Airlines reported a $10 million profit, lifted 1.1% today. Southwest reported a loss of $159 million American dollars following the storms and the mass cancellations last winter. Southwest descended 3.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were talking earlier in the program about inflation and profits. And you know who's making an awful lot of profit? Private equity firms. Looking at data from 2020, companies owned or controlled by private equity employed more than 11 million people in this economy, paid $900 billion in wages and benefits, and generated almost $1.5 trillion worth of gross domestic product. And if you stop there, the data we should say is from a report prepared for the American Investment Council, which is private equity's lobbying group, so grain of salt. But if you stop there and at face value, private equity firms are paragons of capitalism. Reality, however, requires looking beyond face value. Gretchen Morgenson is the co-author of a new book about PE. It's called These Are the Plunderers. Gretchen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Kai. Happy to be here.
The title of this book, These Are the Plunderers. I guess we get to the plunderers part in a minute, but I want to go to the subtitle first. How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America. There's a lot in that sentence, and I want to take the first part first. Private equity runs America. How involved? How deep? Where do they go?
You know, it's funny. There's been this sort of stealth takeover. So the donut that you picked up on your way to work this morning, the nursing home where your grandmother resides, the apartment you rent, we are talking about a very pervasive, very deep involvement by private equity-owned companies.
Let's get to the Rex part then, because this book is, I don't think you'll object to this, it's an indictment of private equity and what it's doing to this economy.
I think it is a major driver of the enormous gulf between rich and poor in this country. And as you well know, we've long talked about this growing gap. Why does it exist? But no one talks about how private equity has contributed to this gap.
Seems to me I should have started with this, but we'll throw it in here now because it's relevant. How does private equity work? Because not everybody knows.
Private equity is a kind of a fancy name for the old leveraged buyouts that everybody recalls, or people who are old enough to recall from the 1980s. A private equity firm raises money from investors, typically institutions like public pension funds. That money it then deploys by buying companies that it believes it can improve their earnings, improve their operations, and then sell them in a pretty quick amount of time.
Improve is doing a lot of work in that sentence because improving involves laying people off, usually cuts, lots of debt piled on, right? I mean, there's a lot going on.
Well, it depends which side of the table you're on. Of course, they call it improving. If you happen to be on the other side of the table as a worker, as a customer, as a pensioner, it is not improving.
Let's do a case study here. The venerable luggage company Samsonite. You talk about them in this book.
Yeah. Samsonite was just an American icon for decades. And unfortunately, it kind of got roped into the leveraged buyout brigade of the 80s and 90s. Long story short, Samsonite became a takeover football, sort of thrown from one private equity to another. So Samsonite became one of these companies that was completely depleted through this process.
The private equity folks will say two things in their defense, probably. One is, we're making these companies more efficient. Capitalism works this way. We're just doing what the market wants, and we're allocating capital, and that's the way it's supposed to be. The other thing they will say is, we are operating within the law.
Totally. There is nowhere in this book that we say that this is lawless or illegal. But for years, Kai, we didn't have the kind of academic research that we now do about this business practice. 10 times the number of bankruptcies occur at companies that are private equity owned. At nursing homes owned by private equity companies, residents experience 10% greater mortality rates. Costs of healthcare rise under private equity owned companies. And so it does, I think, provide a very interesting contrast to their claims of making these companies more efficient. Now, one of the firms that we talk about is the Blackstone Group, which mm-hmm. is very powerful, run by Steve Schwarzman. Blackstone told me, listen, we have created over the past 15 years 200,000 new jobs. And our companies do not go bankrupt at that rate. Only a tiny fraction of 1% of them go bankrupt. And so I said, that's great information. Please, can you provide the data behind that information. And they declined.
At the close of the introduction, actually, it's a note to the readers where you compare the private equity folks to pirates of old, actually, as they cruised about. You ask basically, where is the outrage? Is there enough outrage to change anything? And you know as well as I do, you've been doing this longer than I have, capitalism is slow to change. Do you suppose that this will change, or is this just the state of play?
You know, I do think that there is the capacity for outrage. I don't know if it will be enough to engender change. I think that there are a couple of fixes that can be done very, very easily, quickly. Well, easily, she says, not really. For instance, getting rid of this insane tax loophole where Steve Schwarzman, who made $1.27 billion last year, pays a tax rate that is much lower than, say, a school teacher or a bus driver. Okay, you can change that. They're able to hide sort of behind the names of the companies that you and I know, like Dunkin' Donuts, for instance. But we really need to know exactly their role and whether they have actually got a monopoly in a particular industry, for example.
You know, it's funny. I was going to let you go, but there's one last thing. You mentioned Steve Schwarzman. David Rubenstein is another one. The folks who run and make billions of dollars a year doing it, these private equity funds, are held up as paragons of capitalism in this country.
I think there's this sense that if you are a billionaire, you must be smart and you must be doing the right thing. You have a very small group of winners and you have a very large group of losers. You have pensioners, workers, customers. So the circle of pain is large. But the people who are not in the circle of pain is a very small and very elite group. And I just wonder if this is something that we need to really examine.
Gretchen Morgenson is with Josh Rosner, the author of a new book about private equity. It's called These Are the Plunderers. Gretchen, thanks a lot. It's good to have you back on.
Anytime, Kai.
Coming up on May 1st, the traditional deadline for students to commit to whichever college they are going to enroll at. College athletes in particular have made a tradition of announcing their commitment to a particular school with videos. During the pandemic and the ensuing school shutdowns, a lot of those announcements and celebrations for athletes and non-athletes alike moved to social media, and what came to be called decision day posts became even more important. Now, the pictures and videos in those posts have taken on a new life and cost of their own. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on that.
Search for the hashtag Decision Day on any social media platform, and you'll get a bunch of photos and videos of high school students holding up shirts or slowly unzipping their jackets to show the name of their chosen college.
I'm going to the University of Arkansas, Winnipeg.
I'm going to college at the University of Pittsburgh.
I'm going to St. John's.
You'll also see college hats, balloons, even cakes decorated in school colors.
Yeah, I'd definitely say it is a bit of a brag. It is something to be proud of.
Tina McNellis is 19 and a sophomore at Towson University in Maryland. Her Decision Day photo included a graduation cap decorated with the Towson Tiger. She now has a side hustle as a photographer and books Decision Day photo shoots. Her rate starts at $150 for 2 hours. And some kids are spending more than that on their college announcements, says Jennifer Jesse. She's a college consultant in the Washington, D.C. area.
It's really easy to get sucked in.
Jesse says it's possible to spend hundreds on graphics, custom banners, hair and makeup. This year, to help out, Jesse made her own balloon arch for the kids to stand under.
I've had students who are low income working a job just to get their Decision Day pose paid for.
Jesse says some high schools have Decision Day slideshows announcing where their seniors are going. It's meant to celebrate the kids, but Jesse says it can also put pressure on them to make a gigantic financial decision, sometimes before they have all their financial aid information.
A lot of times you have to tell students, divorce yourself from college signing day if that's what it takes to make the right decision for you. And sometimes students listen, and sometimes students just don't.
Many of the students Jessie works with are the first in their families to go to college. She negotiates with schools on their behalf for better financial aid packages. That's not always done by May 1st. The nonprofit Common App, which provides a platform for students to apply to multiple schools, now manages the College Signing Day initiative. Stephanie Owens oversees it and says there's no reason to rigidly hold to the May 1st announcement date.
Many students will make that decision because of financial aid well into the summer. And that's okay.
One thing college consultant Jennifer Jessie says she'd also like to see, financial aid review day, where kids go through all their scholarships and aid offers to make a decision that's logical, not just emotional. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is funny, but kind of not really funny. Bloomberg had the news first that a couple of Russian pranksters got Fed Chair Jay Powell on the phone back in January by pretending they were Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It raises questions, of course, about how the whole thing happened, the security of the Fed Chair's phone calls. The good news, though, is that at least judging by what was released on Russian state television, Powell didn't say anything to them that he hasn't been saying in public for a very long time. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It's another tech layoff, this one with a twist, though. Dropbox, the cloud storage and file sharing company, said today it's going to lay off 500 people, about 16% of its workforce, and they kind of blamed it on artificial intelligence. CEO Drew Houston said, in part, "Our next stage of growth requires a different mix of skill sets, particularly in AI and early stage product development." So there you go. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.